So for you, my wonderful, beautiful, hardworking, busy professionals, short-term rentals and mid-term rentals are absolutely where the real magic happens when we are getting started and we want to own directly. Hello, hello. My name is Dr. Rachel Gainsbrew, and I am obsessed with all things short-term rentals, revenue streams, and helping you navigate your career, real estate, and your busiest and most wonderful seasons of life. So grab your coffee, get comfortable as you get ready to learn and grow with me. This is the Luxury Rental Doctor Podcast. Hey everyone, Dr. Rachel here. I've got a fantastic podcast episode coming up for you with none other than Brandon Hall, real estate CPA. Now, let me tell you, this conversation was a bit of a roller coaster. Brandon did drop some amazing knowledge bombs. They were a little bit controversial because he broke down the cash flow numbers and he spoke about how he's not all that into cash flow. He did correct himself some, but it was more of equity. But bear in mind, he is speaking specifically to the long-term rental cash flow. And so here's the thing. We knew that. So while we did go down that road, it especially solidified our strategy with high value short-term rentals, high value mid-term rentals. So for you, my wonderful, beautiful, hardworking, busy professionals, short-term rentals and mid-term rentals are absolutely where the real magic happens when we are getting started and we want to own directly. So just wanted to preface that. Buckle up. It's going to be an amazing and exciting ride. You're going to get a lot of insightful discussion between me and Brandon going back and forth. You'll see a little bit of friction, but it was all in the name of getting you guys the most honest and really the truth about maximizing your rental income. So tune in. Let me know what you think. You are in for a treat with this one. Hello, hello, and welcome to another amazing luxury short-term rental and mid-term rental doctor podcast. We have the amazing Brandon Hall here with us from Hall CPA, also known as the Real Estate CPAs. Brandon, I know you from being just a pillar of knowledge in the real estate realm. We've had the opportunity to jump into your Facebook group. I'm a part of your membership community as well. And I know you've had like just such a history of working and helping individuals who are investing in real estate. So super excited to have you here today. Would love for you to introduce yourself to the people.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I always enjoy doing these and I appreciate you being part of our various communities. It's a lot of fun to build and connect with other people that are trying to build some awesome businesses. So my name is Brandon. I run Hall CPA. Started the firm back in 2016. 2016, I went full-time into it right after I was on a Bigger Pockets podcast and then had 10, 20 people a week reaching out going, hey, can you take me on? So that was great. But I was running the firm probably a year before that. So maybe like 2015, technically, when I started. I just was also, it was a side hustle at the time. So went full-time 2016. Today, we have probably 52 U.S. employees and another maybe 35 offshore employees. And then we've got about 900 clients, I think, across the United States. So It's turned into a pretty large operation. It's exceeded my wildest dreams, but we help real estate investors with tax planning and accounting and tax preparation. So if you're a real estate investor and you're earning a high income, much like many physicians, and you're trying to figure out how to mitigate your taxes, we can help you with that. We can help you make sure that your annual compliance is all buttoned up and then also help you with your ongoing bookkeeping and accounting needs if you don't want to do it yourself.
I love that. So Brandon, you've given us an opportunity to just kind of parachute in to where you are right now. But could you tell us a little bit initially, why did you decide, you know what, I'm going to hang my hat on real estate. I'm going to focus on real estate because I believe there's power there. Could you explain to our community why you decided to focus primarily on real estate?
So I graduated college in 2013. I'm 33 years old. And that fall, I started my career at PricewaterhouseCoopers, big four accounting firm. Yeah. Very proud that I was able to do that. And they hire very talented people. I was like, frankly, like out of my element in that world. But I was probably 2 months on the job, and it just hit me like a wall of bricks. I don't even remember why, but I don't know, maybe depression or something. Ooh. But it was like, what is my life's purpose? Is it just to, you know, pound away at the keyboard in this cubicle for the rest of my life and work my way up to partner at PwC and take 20 years to do that? Mm-hmm. Is that really what life's about? Or is there something more? And I started exploring that, and I took some time exploring it, but I kind of decided what I wanted to do. I wanted to create this life of flexibility where I wasn't dependent on this corporate income stream so that I could do whatever I wanted in life, travel, hang out at the beach and just drink whatever I wanted to drink and just not have any responsibilities, right? Keep in mind, I was 23. So it's like, that's what's going through your mind at that point, is this existential crisis, at least for me. So the first question I had to wrestle with was, well, if that's what I want to create, how do I diversify my income stream if I work in this corporate job? And that's where I found real estate. And I had already explored real estate. My parents were investing in real estate at the time. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I'd audited a master's level real estate finance class, two of them, while I was in college. So I'd like, wow, hit it off with the professor, and he had a portfolio, and he's like, come and join my finance classes. And they were way over my head. I had no idea what was going on there. But I sat there and I just tried to absorb it. So I'd always kind of been interested, but then it just hit me as like, oh, I can buy rentals, create cash flow, and that is how I'll diversify my income streams. Now, I've got a lot of differing opinions on that now, a lot different than it was when I first started, but that was what got me into real estate. And so then I was like, well, how do I like help other investors in this space? And also, is real estate even the thing, like, does it actually build wealth? And so I figured, hey, if I could help some other investors, number one, I'll help them. But number two, I could see people that have been doing this for 10, 15, 20 years and assess for myself, is this something that I actually want to do? So that's what kind of drew me to the space initially. It wasn't any like profound moment of, oh man, there's no real estate CPA out there and I'm going to go take that market. I did understand digital probably better than most. I was one of the first, at least that I'm aware of, remote CPA firms, like virtual firms that doesn't have an office, which was pretty bizarre at the time. So there were like some things that I was doing that were definitely against the grain, but that was the drive, was I just want to learn more about real estate. And so I'm going to take on real estate clients and see what they're doing, and I'm going to invest as well.
I love that. So pioneer in the digital space for sure as well. That's awesome. Yeah. I love that story. And I love the fact that you have had initial exposure to it in your family. I know for my family background, there wasn't much exposure at all. So it gave you a little bit of that, a taste of what that would look like. And for our current community, as you mentioned, they're higher income earners. However, the paycheck, the math is a math, and when the paycheck gets to them, Brandon, so we all know it's not how much money you make, it's how much money you get to keep. Am I right?
Right. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so for our listeners, could you start to walk us through how real estate investing can be helpful to start building that wealth outside of the W-2, to start building that generational wealth outside of the W-2?
Yeah. So kind of like the dilemma that I had when I realized, and I was 2 months into my corporate career, realized this is just not for me. I can't do this. I've got to build an exit strategy for myself. Really, the answer is financial independence, right? So what does financial independence mean? A lot of people say financial independence is cash flow. And I used to think that too. And now I believe that is a relatively bad take. And the reason for that is, it's a lot easier to build equity and grow equity in either a company or that you own or real estate by forcing appreciation on it through value add opportunities. It's a lot easier to do that than optimize for cash flow. So what I try to help people, anybody that ever comes to me and like, hey, I'm looking at investing in real estate, one thing that I try to help them understand is it is a lot of work. And the people that are very successful, like our clients that are the most successful, real estate is their business. It's not a side hustle. And I think that's like the core issue that a lot of us have, is for us, real estate is a side hustle and we optimize for cash flow. But the most successful people that I know do not optimize for cash flow. They optimize for value creation. And when you think about it, it makes sense. because why would I try to, and I guess I should back up, because you have to increase your net operating income in order to force the value on the asset. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that the goal is to force the value on the asset up. It's not to buy a single family home to add $500 a month to my portfolio. So it's fundamentally different, even though they still have to improve the cash flow. The end goal is fundamentally different. And when you think about it, it does make sense, because the appreciation that you force can happen a heck of a lot faster than it can when you're trying to add the next $500 a month income stream. That becomes very slow at scale. So what scales is buying larger assets where you can operate the same business model that you've been operating, that you know is proven to increase the value of the asset. That's what scales. But the beautiful thing, to your point, to your question, was how do you, you know, it's not about what you make, it's about what you keep. The beautiful thing about that whole idea of forcing the appreciation on the value is that you can extract that value without paying taxes on it, right? So if you're focused on getting from like your total portfolio from $500 a month to $20,000 a month in cash flow, I would probably tell you that's important. Don't get me wrong, but it's probably the wrong thing to focus on. What you want to focus on is going from $500K in equity to $5 million in equity, and then leveraging the $5 million in equity through cash out refinances, through debt. When you cash out refinance a property, you get the proceeds tax free. It's not a taxable transaction. So you can force appreciation on the asset, and then you can pull that appreciation out and not pay tax on it. So is it better to try to optimize for the next $100 a month, or is it better to try to optimize for forcing $1 million of appreciation? And once you start seeing that, you can see how that snowball goes a lot faster. And I know this is kind of a weird, I'm like tripping over myself right now, because cash flow is important. You have to improve cash flow to force the value, right, of the appreciation. But I think the difference is just that, like me, when I bought my first three unit property, I underwrote it and I was like, this is what the cash flow is going to be. And there's going to be 2% appreciation every single year. And so this is what the cash flow is going to be over time. And I might say, oh, I'm going to add like an HVAC unit, or I'm going to go do a little rehab, and I'm going to be able to take the cash flow from $1,700 to $1,750. And I've done that on multiple of the properties that I purchased. In retrospect, I probably should have said, I'm going to go buy like a 20 unit property, or I'm going to start with these 3 unit properties, and then I'm going to build the equity so that I can roll it into a larger deal that is valued based on the cash flow. And then I'm going to increase the cash flow as fast as I possibly can through value add activities. And then I'm going to leverage that additional appreciation to continue that snowball. And that's not how a lot of us are taught. And that's not how a lot of us think. We just think, I'm making $10,000 a month at my job, so I need $10,000 a month in cash flow to replace my job. And I look at it now and I'm like, no, you need to create a couple million dollars of equity that just eliminate the need for cash flow and eliminate the need for a job. And we're getting to the same spot, but it's just a different focal point, and it'll make you think a little bit differently too. And I realized this recently in my own business. Like, my business is scaling pretty fast, which is mm-hmm. awesome. Mm-hmm. And now it's controlled growth, where it used to be uncontrolled and very, very volatile. So if you're an ex-client listening to this, I'm sorry. We would love to have you back. But it's very controlled now. Mm-hmm. And what I realized is I can optimize for my own earnings mm-hmm. if I would like. And I could earn an amazing amount of money. Or I can go ahead and make investments into labor that I don't necessarily need yet. Mm-hmm. So that when the demand comes, they are trained up and ready to go instead of it being a fire. Mm-hmm. And that's going to cost me money today. But guess what? It's going to keep my top line growing. And mm-hmm. that is what my net worth is effectively tied to. So is it better to double the revenue in my firm or to double my personal income? And then when you factor in taxes, the answer is double the revenue in your firm. Because if your net worth doubles, you're not paying tax on your wealth. You pay tax on your income. Yeah. So I'm always... now just focus on building wealth. Think about it in that lens. Mm-hmm. You'll still get the cash flow out of it, but it's just a little bit different of a thought process. And rentals are not very passive if you're really trying to do this right. Like I said, our most successful clients, they own a bunch of rentals, but it's a real estate business. Everything's systematized. There's lots of people management and leadership, and those are the people you're competing against.
Okay, I love this conversation, and I have so many more questions, but I actually want to take a step back because you said a Sure. couple of things to level set the conversation for those who are just getting started, who are thinking, you know what, I want a side hustle. I want to do something on the side to bring in some money. Okay, so that is the definition of cash flow, wouldn't you say, Brandon? What define cash flow for us and define forced appreciation for us or forced equity, just so that everyone's on the same page and we're not losing anyone in the conversation.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I know I kind of went on a tangent there
too. No, it's so good. I have
notifications
so many
popping up like, dude, you're monologuing way too much here. It's just what's important to me yeah. is that everybody listening to this understand that mm-hmm. I went in to real estate, investing in real estate, thinking that I was going to be financially independent from the cash flow. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I still had my PwC job, that I probably would mm-hmm. have mm-hmm. gotten there. You know, that's not my goal anymore because I have my firm.
Yeah.
But I think what I learned is that like rentals do not cash flow as well as you think that they cash flow.
Mm.
And even when you have a great cash flowing rental, you really have to look at the value on your time.
Mm.
Because I think if you were to look at how much time do I actually spend managing this?
Yeah.
And when did the problems crop up? Like I have the bad luck of problems always cropping up at like 10 p.m. at night in the middle of a movie with my wife, you know? And yes. it's like, how much of that do you really want to put up with? And is that valuable enough for, is that cash flow stream really that valuable?
Yeah.
And sometimes the answer is yes, but I think we don't think about it like that, right? We just look at our spreadsheets and we go, oh, it's going to cash flow great.
Yeah.
So cash flow is revenue minus expenses minus debt payments.
Yeah.
That's what cash flow is. Mm-hmm. So whatever is there at the end, that's what you're going to pocket.
Yeah.
Forced appreciation is if I can increase that cash flow amount, mm-hmm. and this is typically specific to multifamily and commercial property, but if I can increase the cash flow amount, then the value of the asset has also been increased. And this is where you get into the conversation of cap rates, because a capitalization rate is going to be the price of the asset, the net operating income of the asset, so revenue minus expenses, divided by the price of the asset.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a cap rate of 8% for every $100,000 of asset that I buy, I should get $8,000 in net operating income. That's how that calculation works. So if I increase the net operating income to 10% and the cap rates are still 8%, then that is, I don't know, 105K or something like that. It's like the value of my asset goes from 100 to 105 or whatever that calculation turns out to be, 110. When you increase the cash flow mm-hmm. on larger assets, you can mm-hmm. force appreciation on the assets. And then you can decide, what do I do with this extra few thousand dollars that I've just created? Do I leave it there or do I cash it out and go buy another asset? And that is what gets the snowballing going at a large level. You can also force appreciation on like single family homes, but it's just in a different way. It's, I got to buy it right. That's the key. I got to buy, it's the key to anything. But if I buy a dumpster fire property and then I rehab it, then I've forced appreciation as well. So there, that's what I mean. It's just, we're adding value to the asset by either increasing the cash flow or on single family properties, doing a rehab that gets us to where the market is willing to pay a lot of money for that asset.
Okay. I love that. So with the forced appreciation, is that what you mean when you say you're optimizing for value creation? I know you mentioned that a little bit earlier.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry. So when I say forced appreciation, that's mm-hmm. the value creation. You're forcing the value to go up, thus you're earning equity. And there's a couple of reasons why I think that this is a superior way to think about investing in real estate. The first is, when you think about value creation, you're just thinking about it differently. You're not just buying the next asset and just letting it sit there. You're only going to buy assets that fit a business model that you have created that is proven to create value. And that is something that scales. And that's something that's repeatable. Mm-hmm. And that's something that has systems, right? So it's not just me walking down the street, and I'm guilty of this. I've got quite a few properties I did this with. I'm not just walking down the street going, oh, that looks like a cool property. I'm going to go buy it and I'm going to add to my cash flow stream. It's very different. I'm treating it legitimately like a business. And I think that is how everybody should be thinking about investing. It's not something to take lightly. But the other two reasons are, when you're focused on that type of investing, I believe that the value creation happens a lot faster.
Right.
And if it happens faster, it can snowball faster. So you can buy another property, do the same thing, and over and over and over. And when you get that snowball going, I could cash flow $0. Like, I could break even cash flow. But if I'm able to increase the value of properties from $1 to $10 million, everybody would agree that that's a win. And obviously that's potentially an unrealistic example. But my point is that I want to focus on the equity build. And then the last reason, and really second to last reason, is I can extract that equity build without paying taxes, mm-hmm. right? So cash flow, I got to pay tax on every single day. What if you didn't have any cash flow, but your equity was appreciating at a rapid pace? But you could cash that equity out and not pay taxes, right? So again, going back to, it's more about what you keep. And then the last piece is, I think that it's worth more. It's a higher ROI on your time. So if you're going to be spending a lot of time managing the rental and building a portfolio, you might as well try to get the highest ROI on your time possible, which is going to typically mean buy larger assets and force appreciation on those assets. At least that's my experience and my personal experience, as well as watching some of our most successful clients operate their portfolios.
Okay, I love it. So I'm not usually controversial on my calls with guests, but Brandon, what if I'm greedy and I want both cash flow and equity? And I'm looking at some short-term rental strategies where I am seeing the cash flow. So I may not get that initial return on my time because you're right, it is not passive, but I'm seeing some cash flow. I'm seeing equity opportunities. What's your take on that, my friend?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I own a short-term rental. I own a bunch of single family properties. I say these things, but you know, it's more of like do what I say, not as I do type of situation. And I'm just saying, like, if you want to go all out, then go upstream, large multifamily, commercial property. That's where you need to focus. Now, for the rest of us, short-term rentals are awesome. Okay. So short-term rentals are great from a cash flow perspective. We have clients that absolutely crush. But I do think what still rings true in the short-term rental game is it is a business. The most successful short-term rental owners that I know run their short-term rentals like a business. So it's not just, oh, I'm going to buy a short-term rental and add $30,000 of cash flow. I got to work to get 5-star reviews. I got to make sure my listings are updated. My pictures are amazing. I got to do market research on a consistent basis to make sure that I'm out competing everybody on price and value, right? Yeah. And those things, ironically, will increase your cash flow, which then in some short-term rental markets can also increase the value of your asset, depending on who you're able to flip it to and sell it to at the end. So you still have to run it like a business, but short-term rentals are great. They are a lot of work. My short-term rental, going back to what I was saying, I always get the call Saturday at like 10 p.m. Hey, you know, trouble checking in. I've tried a lot of things to solve that problem. I still get it every once in a while. There's some pain that comes with the territory of being a short-term rental owner, but it is a great way to get into real estate and, in my opinion, add a little bit more value than simply running it as a long-term rental. Because you're running it as a business, you're going to be able to extract more value out of it as a result versus just buying something and letting it run passively. Yeah. And we do a ton of tax planning with real estate investors on short-term rentals.
Yeah.
And a lot of our investors will be very actively involved in the first year.
Yep.
And I'm happy to talk about why. But then they'll flip it to a passive activity the next year. So they'll put a property management company on it and just walk away and collect the cash flow. And I think that's a good way to go too. You hustle at the beginning, add the value, and then you step back and let somebody else run it.
Yeah. And I think it's a really powerful model. I was going to say that. I was like, come on, Brandon, you've got a team of VAs. Someone can take that call for you. But so year one, you want to put in the work for year one to take advantage of the tax benefits that are out there. We'll segue into that conversation. And then you have an opportunity to switch it up. We use the midterm rental strategy year two. I had a guest in our property for 11 months due to fire damage. So that one is kind of semi-passive because they don't need much. They're just there. They're locals and they're waiting for their property to get repaired so that they can go back home. So those have been amazing guests. But let's circle back to the short-term rental. So you mentioned that there's some short-term rental benefits. One thing that I did is my husband, he manages our properties. He qualifies for rep status. So that's like a double whammy potentially. But let's just unpack some of those words that I just dropped there. Let's try some definitions and unpack it for the people.
Yeah. So when somebody working a full-time job or running a business full-time starts to invest in real estate, you typically learn about the passive activity loss rules. The passive activity loss rules impact every single taxpayer in the United States, whether or not you're in real estate. Just nobody knows about it until you buy real estate. And the reason for that is these rules make your rental, they call your rentals passive versus non-passive. And we can use non-passive and active interchangeably, but non-passive is the technical term. So we've got these rules essentially create two buckets of income, passive income and non-passive income or loss. The problem is that the losses from passive activities, which rentals are passive activities, the losses can only be used to offset income from passive activities. Well, if I am a physician making 400K at my W-2 job, that is a non-passive activity. That's not passive because I am materially participating in my W-2 job every single day, right? Yep. That's a non-passive activity. So if I go and buy a rental property and then the rental property produces a tax loss, that tax loss is passive, and the passive loss cannot offset my W-2 income, cannot be used to reduce my W-2 income. Instead, the passive loss just gets suspended and carried forward on my tax returns until I have passive income from passive sources. Passive income could come from rentals if in future years they produce passive income, but most don't because of depreciation. So even though I have positive cash flow, I get to take a depreciation expense every single year, which would tell the IRS, oftentimes results in me telling the IRS that I lost money, even though I had positive cash flow. So from a tax perspective, that's great because I made cash flow and I didn't pay tax on it today. But the loss, the tax loss, gets suspended and carried forward unless I have actual positive income, taxable income, even after the depreciation deduction. What happens with people that are buying long-term rentals is they'll build out a portfolio. The cash flow from the rentals, they don't pay tax on because the rentals are producing so much depreciation and tax losses that come with that. So the cash flow is all sheltered in the portfolio, but their tax losses are stacking up because they're getting large. As they become suspended, they're getting larger and larger and larger. So every year we start with a $10,000 tax loss, then it becomes 50, then it becomes 150, then it becomes $500,000 of tax losses that are just being kicked to next year in the hopes that we have passive income. So the way around the passive activity loss rules, there's two primary ways. One is to qualify as a real estate professional. To qualify as a real estate professional, you have to spend 750 hours in real property trades or businesses and more time in real property trades or businesses than you do anywhere else. The latter test, more time in real estate than anywhere else, that kicks out everybody with a full-time job. Anybody running a business full-time, you cannot qualify as a real estate pro. Your spouse could qualify as a real estate pro if he or she is staying at home with the kids or doesn't have a job for whatever reason. They could qualify, but it's that second test of more time in real estate than anywhere else. If you have a W-2 job, you're not going to be able to convince the IRS examiner if you were audited or the tax court that you spent more time in real estate than you did at your W-2 job.
Okay, so, hang on one second, Brandon. I want to make sure that everyone who's sitting in the back hears that, because I get this question every single time. I'm a full-time trauma surgeon. I'm going to apply for rep status. No, you cannot. It's a waste of your time. You're going to get caught. Can we just say it one more time for those sitting in the back?
Yeah. So we get a lot of that too. And there are accountants out there that will absolutely claim real estate professional status for you. Most accountants are conflict averse. They like making people happy. Whatever. Like, is the IRS really going to figure this out? Nah, it'd be fine, right? I'll just book that. That's a problem, because if the accountant's doing that for you, then guess what? They're probably doing it for other people. It only takes one person in that client group to get audited for something like this before the IRS auditor goes, oh, interesting that this person, this accountant, was erroneously claiming this. Let's go pull all those tax returns that have Schedule E's on them, and let's go see if they were erroneously claimed on all of them. That's how a lot of these audits end up working, by the way. So if you're finding an accountant that's just like, oh yeah, we'll just bend the rules, it's totally fine, that should be a red flag for you. And that drastically is going to increase your audit risk. Yeah. The last few years, or really the last 6 months, we have personally experienced audits on real estate professional status and short-term rentals going up pretty quickly. Oh. And I don't know if it's because we're just talking about this stuff a lot and people are finding us and going, you guys can help me because you clearly know the topic, or if it's because audit rates are actually increasing on these types of tax returns. Okay. But we used to get like one a quarter coming in, like from our website. So people, they start audited, then they go, oh, I need help, and we're going to contact Brandon's team, not our clients getting audited.
Okay, yeah, let's clarify that. I was like, are they auditing your team or you're finding
clients? No, we've had like two, I think, clients get audited, but these are all clients that are coming to us.
Gotcha.
Already in the audit.
Okay.
And now we're getting like two a month from that intake. And so it's crazy.
It's not fun, and, guys. It's not fun.
Yeah. I would just be really careful. And you could say all the right things, right? Well, I'm going to do all the work. Mm-hmm. I'm a full-time surgeon, but I'm also going to be a full-time real estate investor. And to be honest with you, like when I was building my firm, I spent 80 to 100 hour weeks, not kidding, working, grinding away for probably 3 years. Nonstop. Yeah. Same. So you could do it. You can 100% do it.
They don't care.
I know you can do it. IRS is not going to believe you, right? That's the problem. They're not going to believe you. Mm-mm. And the tax court's not going to believe you. And nobody yet, there's not a single tax court case where the taxpayer worked a full-time job, a real full-time job, and convinced the tax court that they were a real estate professional. Not a single one. So a lot of people have tried and everybody has failed. So my suggestion is, if you are getting all hot to trot to be a real estate pro, think about it a little bit more strategically than let's just make that election on our tax return. You got to really think it through.
And so if you have a spouse and their full-time job, maybe they're a stay-at-home spouse or they're doing some other things, they can potentially qualify for that. But if you're a dual family with both people working full-time, physician, pharmacist, whatever it may be, and you have student loans that you're contending with, this still would not be the best strategy for you. However, help is on the way with short-term rentals. Can we talk a little bit about that? And that I think that's really the secret sauce of short-term rentals, honestly.
So short-term rentals, so we were actually writing a big guide on real estate professional status back in, I think it was 2020, because we were getting a lot of people coming to us saying, well, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I can work a full-time job and also qualify as a real estate pro. We're just like, okay, we're tired of having this conversation. So let's just write a big old ebook on it and we'll do all sorts of citations. That way people believe that what we are saying is true. And through that process, we discovered, and I don't think we were the first that discovered this. There was another platform called Bradford Tax that had already written about it. In like 2018 or something, 2019. But through this process of writing about real estate professional status, we realized that Airbnbs and VRBOs were probably an exception to this, were probably carved out of all of this. And the reason is there's a regulation in section 469 that says if your average period of customer use is less than or equal to 7 days, then you do not have a rental activity. And the way that section 469 is written says that real estate professional status only applies to rental activities. So if I don't have a rental activity, then in the context of this code section, what I really have is just a regular old business. And I don't have to qualify as a real estate pro to run my business. That wouldn't make any sense, right? So a short-term rental is not a rental activity. It's just a regular business, which means that if you don't have to qualify as a real estate pro, you don't have to worry about that test of spend more time in real estate than anywhere else. So you can buy short-term rentals. You can materially participate in the short-term rentals and they will be non-passive. They get around all the passive loss rules and traps. And if they're non-passive, if your short-term rental is non-passive, guess what else is non-passive? Your W-2 income is non-passive, right? So if my short-term rental is non-passive and my W-2 income is non-passive, then if my short-term rental produces a tax loss through cost seg studies and bonus depreciation, then I can offset my W-2 income with my short-term rental. And I can buy a short-term rental every single year and just rinse and repeat this strategy. Extremely powerful. And we've been helping, like I said, about like two a month now, two new ones coming in the front door on a lot of short-term rental audits. It's been very interesting to watch. A lot of the auditors don't really know how to navigate. So we've found ourselves doing a lot of education and we've had several no change audits at this point, which is great because we get to say, hey, look, like the auditors all, I'm actually literally doing a presentation on this in 9 minutes on what we're seeing in short-term rental audits. So, so right after we end up here, that's where I'm going next. We've got like 800 people registered for this webinar. It's awesome.
But
it's short-term rental audits. Like what we're seeing as we're going through and getting these no change audits, a lot of the auditors start with, you have to be a real estate professional. And so we have to start by saying, no, we don't. Here's why. Bam, bam, bam. And then here's all of our time logs and documentation. So if you have a CPA that does not understand this and you're getting audited for something like this, you should press pause and find somebody that can really help you, because that's another thing we've learned is where we lose these audits, they're already way too far into the process before they give us a call. So we can't really help the auditor get to the right conclusion.
Oh, this is so good. And I know you touched on bonus depreciation, you touched on cost segregation studies, and we've actually had a cost segregation expert come in on a couple of our episodes. So guys, be sure to follow up. We'll link those episodes there. And I want you guys to be sure you're following Brandon and the community, because they provide so much education on a weekly basis. You can hop into the community, ask questions. They're extremely attentive. I absolutely love that. We don't have to unpack all of those right here, right now. But thank you for all of that. And that is why I'm excited. That's why I'm bullish on short-term rentals. I know haters are going to hate, but I absolutely love this strategy. It's been powerful for me and my family. So I want to go ahead, Brandon.
The one real quick thing I want to say on the short-term rentals is just, I think there was a craze. I mean, there was definitely a craze of buying short-term rentals.
Yes.
And from our experience, there was a tax craze associated with that as well. And, you know, it's only because we see that piece of the picture every single day.
Yep.
But I've started trying to give this advice over the past few months of, if you're buying short-term rentals, just make sure that the tax tail's not wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Like, make sure that it's actually a good deal.
Ooh.
Make sure that the cash flow is actually there. Underwrite the property well. Make sure that you get all the inspections. Don't just jump into it going, oh man, I'm going to save $30,000 in taxes. Because yeah, you could save $30,000 in taxes, which is awesome, but you could also lose $500,000 in value. So just be careful.
You're absolutely right. And I've seen it where the property can't get insured because it needs a brand new roof. It's like, oh my gosh, like immediately. And you're already feeling a little bit strapped. So the advice is very important. Make sure you're getting an inspection. I know it's a competitive market right now, but you're absolutely right. Any word, Brandon, I know that we've had in the past 100% bonus depreciation, 80%, we're at 60% now. Any word on the possibility of us getting back to 100%?
I think that if Republicans sweep, then you will see an extender bill later this year, probably end of December. They've already got it all built out. It's currently sitting with the Senate. And I mean, they'll add a lot of things to it if Republicans sweep. So we might not actually see it until Q1 of next year. But yeah, I think that you'll see a flurry of tax changes and tax extenders. I don't know if bonus depreciation will go back to 100%.
Okay.
More likely it'll be extended at 60% for some period of time. We'll see something. Now, if Democrats win, I don't know what you'll see. You probably will not see extender bills.
Gotcha. Okay, that's good to know. All right, so we have kind of like a super quick last three questions. I call them my Rachel Resilient Three. Can you share a moment when you felt completely burnt out and how you overcame it?
Yeah, I have felt burnt out many a times. And it's typically related to just setting poor expectations. Like clients can really get to you mentally.
Yeah.
But when I reflect on it, a lot of times, not all the time, but most of the time, it's because I haven't set very good expectations, which kind of translates actually to how do you run a good short-term rental business, ironically.
100%, yeah.
So, you know, that's burned me out multiple times in the past. I've had, you know, all sorts of things. And all good experience in retrospect. I think what keeps me going is just rewriting my goals. Anytime that I really feel burned out, I just rewrite my goals.
Ooh.
And then I figure out how far off track, where am I off track and how far off track? And if I got back on track, I'd probably feel good. I have business goals, wealth goals, relationship goals, and health goals, because I've learned that is what, those are the four kind of pillars for me that keep my energy up on an ongoing basis. So whenever I'm feeling burned out, I review those and assess, am I off track? And typically I'm off track in one or two of those areas.
Love that. Question number two, what's a book or resource that completely changed your perspective on life or work?
How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Amazing book. It's probably the only book that I've ever reread. I've reread it a couple times and just teaches you how to win friends and influence people, how to deal with people and how to motivate people.
Love that. Last but not least, what's the craziest real estate story you've heard or you've experienced?
I've experienced a few crazies, but probably the most insane one is actually, I think it might still be up on BiggerPockets. I haven't checked recently, but on BiggerPockets multiple years ago, there was a guy, I forget his name, and I wish I didn't forget his name, because he's a pretty, at the time at least, he was a pretty well-known guy, and I'm sure he still is.
Mm-hmm.
But he was flipping properties in California, and he had a squatter.
Oh my goodness.
That refused to leave, but knew how to work the system. Uh-huh. And so he went on Bigger Pockets and was like, hey, this is my issue. Does anybody know how to deal with this? But then he turned the forum thread into just like a place to post regular updates. And I want to say it took him like 2 or 3 years to get the squatter out of the property.
My gosh.
Like, that was insane to me. Just, it was like, okay. We have a lot of clients that invest in California and do so very successfully. But I was like, that scares me, man. I don't think I would ever pull the trigger on a California property. And there's nothing against, you know, if you're investing in California, right. You know, you do you. But that will always be burnt into my mind of just this insane story. I read every single update like it was like another episode of Love is Blind or something, you know.
It reminds me of the one, someone got arrested in New York, right? And it's the landlord that got arrested for trying to kick out the squatter. So those
are yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's how does that work?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Thank you so much, Brandon. You have shared so many invaluable insights with us today. Brandon, how can our listeners connect with you and learn more about what you're doing, your services at Hall CPA?
Yeah, so you can find me personally on X or Twitter at @BHallCPA. You can also find me on LinkedIn if you just search Brandon Hall CPA. But if you're interested in exploring some of our resources, we've got a podcast, we've got that Facebook group, free and paid. We've got a bunch of white papers and stuff. If you're interested in looking at that, you can go to our website. It's www.therealestatecpa.com.
Awesome, guys. We'll go ahead and share all of those links in the show notes. Again, thank you. Thank you all for joining us today. Look forward to our chat next time. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you.